This reading is taken from the Message version. Jesus went across to the Mount of Olives, but he was soon back in the temple again. Swarms of people came to him. He sat down and taught them. The religious scholars and Pharisees led in a woman who had been caught in an act of adultery. They stood her in plain sight of everyone and said,
"Teacher, this woman was caught red-handed in the act of adultery. Moses in the law gives orders to stone such persons. What do you say?"
They were trying to trap him into saying something incriminating so they could bring charges against him. Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger in the dirt. They kept at him, badgering him. He straightened up and said,
"The sinless one among you, go first, throw the stone."
Bending down again, he wrote some more in the dirt. Hearing that, they walked away, one after another, beginning with the oldest. The woman was left alone. Jesus stood up and spoke to her.
"Woman, where are they? Does no one condemn you?"
"No one, Master."
"Neither do I,"
said Jesus.
"Go on your way. From now on, don't sin."
Jesus once again addressed them.
"I am the world's light. No one who follows me stumbles around in the darkness. I provide plenty of light to live in."
The Pharisees objected.
"All we have is your word on this. We need more than this to go on."
Jesus replied,
"You're right that you only have my word, but you can depend on it being true. I know where I've come from and where I go next. You don't know where I'm from or where I'm headed. You decide according to what you can see and touch. I don't make judgments like that. But even if I did, my judgment would be true because I wouldn't make it out of the narrowness of my experience, but in the largeness of the one who sent me, the Father. That fulfills the conditions set down in God's law, that you can count on the testimony of two witnesses. And that is what you have. You have my word, and you have the word of the Father who sent me."
They said,
"Who is a so-called father of yours?"
Jesus said,
"You're looking right at me and you don't see me. How can you expect to see the Father? If you knew me, you would at the same time know the Father."
He gave this speech in the treasury while teaching in the temple. No one arrested him because his time wasn't yet up. Then he went over the same ground again.
"I'm leaving and you're going to look for me. But you're missing God in this and are headed for a dead end. There is no way you can come with me."
The Jews said,
"So is he going to kill himself? Is that what he means by you can't come with me?"
Jesus said,
"You're tied down to the mundane. I'm in touch with what is beyond your horizons. You live in terms of what you see and touch. I'm living on other terms. I told you that you're missing God in all this. You're at a dead end. If you won't believe I am who I say I am, then you're at the dead end of sins. You're missing God in your lives."
They said to him,
"Just who are you anyway?"
Jesus said,
"What I've said from the start. I have so many things to say that concern you, judgments to make that affect you. But if you don't accept the trustworthiness of the one who commanded my words and acts, none of it matters. That is who you are questioning, not me, but the one who sent me."
They still didn't get it, didn't realize that he was referring to the Father. So Jesus tried again.
"When you raise up the Son of Man, then you will know who I am. That I'm not making this up, but speaking only what the Father taught me. The one who sent me stays with me. He doesn't abandon me. He sees how much joy I take in pleasing him."
When he put it in these terms, many people decided to believe.
Thanks, guys. Okay, what an amazing passage. It's some of your favourites, I've asked you. Just to clear up verse 52. Turn the clicker on first, hang on. Okay, no, back one. Okay, so Jesus writes in the dust, and it's John 8, 1 to 30. But just quickly look back at verse 52. I just want to clear this up. Verse 52 of the last, just above that in your Bibles, you'll see this, that some of the earliest manuscripts don't have it in. But the modern scholars agree that it is a story that was circulated by word of mouth, and it's completely trustworthy. So we'll just go with that, okay? It is a real event in Jesus' life, but you'll notice that little aside. So this passage is full of Jesus, judgmental people, justice, dust, discernment, and deliverance. And it throws up a whole lot of questions. And if you know me, you know I love questions. So what was Jesus writing in the dust with his finger, and why? What does this passage then have to do with us now? How can we let Jesus change our behavior and attitudes? And more importantly, will we? And how is I am the light of the world so brilliantly timed? We will spend the majority of the time in the first 11 verses. But because we're doing a series on John, I wanted to read the whole of it, all right? But we'll just spend a minute in that last bit, because the first bit is just amazing. So let's start with the corker, this corker of a question. Just what was Jesus writing in the dust with his finger and why? Okay, you've got 30 seconds to turn to the person on either side. If you don't have a person, just think. 30 seconds to answer that question. Go. Come on, talk. Okay, that's it. I told you, 30 seconds. Lots of talking, fantastic. Okay, now you'll recognise maybe some of your answers in these ones, because theologians and preachers have given us shed loads of opinions on this. Here are a few. The first one, and pardon the patronising tone, it was a very difficult question. So Jesus was biding time and sending up an arrow prayer like, please, Lord, find me a parking space. We've all done it. Because he didn't know what to do with his thoughts, so he was waiting to collect them. This is the Son of God. He certainly had collected his thoughts. Now, I'm not saying that Jesus wouldn't have liked a doodling book as a child, because they're all the rage. And I think it's quite funny to think he could have had the three wise men in his adult colouring book. I think it's quite cute. But that wasn't what he was doing. He was not, I do not think, biding time because it was a difficult question. The second one put forward was this. This is brilliant. Jesus was writing, wait for the pun, in Sanskrit. Sanskrit? Okay, now I'm sorry, but for the purpose of what? Presumably, the reason it then says in verse 7 that they were badgering him was because he was translating all for them as well. Sanskrit, I've got to tell you what it is in Hebrew and Aramaic. What? The next one. Oh no, not that one. Jesus was scrawling down the names of prostitutes that the religious leaders had visited in town for their own pleasure. So, you guys cannot throw the stone because you use women like this. Well, number one, there's absolutely no evidence at all, but also she wasn't a prostitute. The fourth one. Jesus was writing down the names of the accusers from the oldest to the youngest, and they were so amazed that Jesus knew their names supernaturally that they were literally silenced, left in the order that they came, that he wrote them, all right? Trouble with that is, that sounds like the kind of thing I would do. Look, guys, aren't I amazing? I know your name, and I know your name, and I know your name, and there they all are. And actually, it doesn't sound like something God would do, because Jesus always goes deeper than our names. Okay, superficial, their names are superficiality, so he always goes deeper. Doesn't really work for me. The fifth one, Jesus would write in the sins of each of the religious leaders in the sand. How embarrassing. They were stunned, they were convicted, and they ran. Again, this is about personal sin, this passage, but quite frankly, it's way bigger than that, because Jesus would have condemned them in their sin and sent them off, which is the exact opposite of what it actually does. So that doesn't fit for me either. This one, I think a lot of Christians will think this one. Jesus was dealing down in the dust because the woman was metaphorically in the dust, and he was writing something to her. Something like, don't worry, love, I've got it covered. Now, I'm being deliberately facetious. I don't think that's it either. Jesus kneeling down, writing in the dust in front of her was healing for her, but I don't think that's it. So the reasons these different ideas have been put forward is because the text doesn't tell you. It doesn't. It just says he wrote with his finger in the dirt. And we are really curious beings, right? Now, I think it's great to be curious as long as we dig deep enough in the right place. You dig deep enough in the wrong place and you end up with Sanskrit. Okay? John doesn't spell it out for us, either because it's not important or because it was symbolic and it was more obvious to the hearers at the time. I think it is important for several reasons, which is why I'm standing up here, or it's going to be a short service. So I think the probability is we're missing something that the original audience would have totally got, because it is a highly symbolic act, and it's teaching by action and gesture. And if you remember Exodus 31:18, if you don't, it's fine. It says, tables of stone written with the finger of God. There's lots and lots in there that's symbolic, because Jesus is the author of the law, remember. Okay? The text, though, is in a context. There's a context. It's in a Jewish context. And it's in Jesus' Jewish context. If you take out the red word, we're in major trouble here. Sorry about knocking this. If we're honest, we're really lazy at looking at Jesus' context and his Jewish context, and therefore we miss a whole load of it. Basic information is lost, okay? So let's go back to the passage and have a really, really good look. Let's dig in the right place. Jesus was sitting, it says, in the sitting down teaching the crowd at the temple. If you don't like history, don't shut off now, because this is really important. This is the day after the Feast of the Tabernacles has finished. Have a look at John verse 37. And this is the morning after the last night of the festival. Now, there is a quick aside here, because some scholars have done a mind-bending but brilliantly convincing thing of laying all of John out in a different chronology. So you end up with this being the Sabbath. I haven't got time to go there. So for the point of today, can you just stick with the fact that this is the morning after the last night of the Tabernacles? Who here remembers anything about the festival, the Feast of the Tabernacles? Emma Alga did a brilliant thing. Anyone remember anything about it? Anyone know what the word for the Feast of Tabernacles is in Hebrew? I'm looking at Desta. Sukkot. I might have been saying it correctly, but it's in Hebrew. It was the big festival celebrating all that God had done for them. Special focus on the wilderness and these cool shelters they built. Remember that? It's also one of the three pilgrimage festivals. The other ones being Pesach, which is Passover, and Shavuot, which is grain harvest. Keep with me if you're not into history. Sukkot was totally, totally wrapped up, though, with knowing that sins were forgiven, because it follows 5 days after Yom Kippur, which is the Day of Atonement. Yom Kippur, 5 days, Feast of Tabernacles. Okay? So they've got this whole thing rolling around in their heads. So Yom Kippur is really important. Just mark that. We'll come back to that in a bit. So Sukkot was very important. It lasted 8 days and eight nights. See Leviticus 23:33. And every night, who's here been to a Coldplay concert? Anyone? Those kind of throbbing light festival things. This is nothing. These guys, for eight nights, lit these things. They lit the menorahs and the priests. I don't know how old these guys were. They danced all night with the Levites dancing and singing. So they had this light festival, four of these, every night for eight nights. Okay? Jesus is talking in the temple the morning after the last one. Okay? That's what's the background to this. Sukkot was the seventh final festival in the year at harvest time, and this is the morning after the final one. So let's go back. Jesus is sitting there talking to the people, but where in the temple was he sitting? 30 seconds, this is important. Where was he sitting? Go! 30 seconds. Okay, that was probably 15 seconds. Anybody think they know where he was sitting? I'm not going to pick on anyone. I didn't know. It's brilliant. Okay, whenever someone was caught in adultery, the man and the woman and two witnesses were brought to the Nicanor gate in the temple and accused. The Nicanor gate, can I work the little thingy? Oh, no, I can't. I don't know where it is. Anyway, the Nicanor gate, see that, those steps? That is the Nicanor gate. This thing here is the court of the women. Okay, this is really important. He was sitting in front of that gate. Now, that's where they were brought. The Nicanor gate is fascinating. Go and Google it if you have time. It's on the western side of the women's court. It was made out of brass. Okay, anyone was allowed in the court of the women, but guess what? The women were not allowed past that gate into the temple, or the Holy of Holies. They were not allowed past it. So Jesus was sitting on the floor. I don't think he was sitting, he could have been on the steps, but he was on this side, which puts him in the women's courtyard. Now, I think it's fascinating because Jesus is God wrapped in skin. Yes? So he took God's presence out of the Holy of Holies to the people who weren't allowed to it, which I think is amazing. He was the tabernacle. And John has already brought that up in John 1:14. It says, so the word became flesh and tabernacled with us. So Jesus is the shelter in the festival of shelter, which I think is amazing. And the presence of Yahweh is Jesus out there where the people were blocked. And I think the religious leaders would have had a fit if they had known that the Holy of Holies had come out to the women. Okay, that was just a no-goer. You don't do that. And Jesus, God wrapped in skin, came out, which I think is really funny. And I think it's a subtle detail, but Jesus is speaking and teaching at the Nicanor gate where lepers were taken, women who'd had children were taken just after childbirth at their most vulnerable. And I think, I think it's absolutely fantastic. So, Jesus is always found at the place where pain, regret and sadness are found, and where redemption, healing, and forgiveness are needed. I have absolutely no idea what he was teaching the crowd when the Pharisees interrupted, but it may well have been about being the true gate and all that, I don't know. But what about us? Are we found where pain, sadness, and regret are found? And do we offer God's love and redemption power? Or do we preach, frighteningly, a different gospel that has God far removed and distant from the very people he came to save? Do we locate God in the Holy of Holies, where people have to climb stairs of behaviour? Because that's sometimes what we ask, okay? And they're not very inviting at that, are they? As a church, what do we put onto people? Anyhow, the Pharisees brought her to the right place, the right person, but the wrong motive. Because they weren't interested in Jesus meeting her needs or anything to do with that. They wanted him to break the law. This woman is a slut, Jesus. Judge her according to the Moses law. As Chris so brilliantly pointed out, they think they've got him. Because if he does condemn her, the Romans will have him. You cannot kill someone for adultery. It's not a killable offence. But if he doesn't say, then he'll be taken in front of the Sanhedrin. And anyway, Jesus has been preaching love, forgiveness, mercy, and this would really muck up his reputation with the people. How brilliant. So the Pharisees are really delighted. But Jesus knew that the punishment was stoning, okay, because he knew the scriptures. Adultery is mentioned in the Ten Commandments, it's mentioned in awful Gospels, and it's mentioned in 10 other books of the Bible. But he also knew this, as Chris also said, the Pharisees had missed the whole point of the Feast of the Tabernacle. The Feast of the Tabernacle just ended. It was about forgiveness, mercy, redemption, changed lives, gratitude to God, celebration. But instead of that, they point the finger. So the temple, heaven and earth meet, oh, they do, in Jesus. No, we're interested in pointing the finger. Jesus also knew, as Chris also said, that a man and a woman should be brought, and they'd only grab the woman in a state of undress. No man. Why? Maybe he'd run away. Maybe it was a setup. Maybe they felt really sorry for him. We have no idea, but they did not bring a man. They didn't bring the witnesses either. See 10 and 11. Why didn't they bring the witnesses? So it's really odd. It does mean that they knew they'd broken the law at this point, the oral law. They knew that, the Moses law, they knew that, which means they'd chosen to ignore it. And I think maybe they're just in a rush. Jesus was here, opportunistic, let's stitch him up. Since Moses, how many laws had the Pharisees developed since the Mosaic law through all? Any ideas? How many do you think, since Moses' law, the Ten Commandments, how many had the Pharisees added? How many have they got now at this point? 613. They spent every moment trying to keep them, okay? So by Jesus' day, they'd basically made a hedge. They thought, we better not break the law. We better not step anywhere near breaking the law. So we're going to put all these things in. And before you realise it, this hedge is obviously right around it. And ironically, Deuteronomy 4:2, it says this, you shall not add to the words which I command you, nor take anything from it. Problem. And Matthew 23:4 says they bound heavy burdens hard to bear and lay them on men's shoulders. So their extra laws had made a heartless, cold, and arrogant righteousness. These had tragic consequences. And I've got a few. This is the consequences of what they'd done. They focus on the outside. Try and see yourself in this, by the way, because I saw myself all over this. They focus on the outside, not the inside. Hear an echo. They washed their hands until they bled. They were afraid of the diseased. They were afraid of the sinful. They were terrified of failing to measure up to the demanding God. But they were also secretly quite proud when they did. Secondly, new laws were added for every new situation. Can you seriously imagine? People became accountable to them, not to God. Echoes of church history. New. People stopped discerning with God. Well, there's no need because you discern with the priest, don't you? It created a judgmental spirit. No surprises there. The Pharisees confused personal preference with divine law. This is what I like. This is now divine law. Excuse me. It produced inconsistencies. It created a false standard of righteousness. It became a burden to the people, and it was strictly external. So can you imagine seriously how trapped these guys felt? We say Jesus was trapped. These guys were seriously trapped. right deep inside. So I think Jesus is amazing in this because he wants to release these guys and he wants to release her because these are seriously trapped. And superbly, Jesus understands the oral law, but he rejects it. So let's go back to the text. We have them breaking their own oral law, okay? And we also have them... So the oral law, they'd already broken it anyway. They hadn't brought the man and the woman. But then they broke it because then they had written this into their oral law. Listen to this. This is brilliant. They had written that when the accuser was brought to the Nicanor gate that I had, the priest was required to stoop down and write the name of the accused in the dust and his sin. Why? Because you could not punish someone until they 100% knew what they'd done. Because you might be put to death for something you didn't know you had done. That was their oral law. So Jesus, he's so brilliant. Jesus shows them by scribbling that they are not keeping the oral law because he didn't bring them up. But he is. So I'm just paraphrasing. Jesus didn't say this, but this is the sort of thing. By writing on the ground, I will respect your silly tradition, which has no basis in the law of Moses. Although maybe now I've written on the ground, you'll change that. But I will not respect, however, the way you treat this woman, caught in adultery, asking if she, but not the partner, should be stoned to death. Don't put me to the test regarding adultery if you have no intention of carrying out what is clearly said in the law of Moses, namely the adulterer and the adulteress should be put to death. So, what do you write on the ground? It's highly probable he wrote in Aramaic these words, don't commit adultery. To make it clear that she had been shown her error, and therefore, judgment could follow. Then the text says, and we've heard, he stood up and he said this, he who is without sin among you, let him cast a stone. John 8:7. But the Aramaic actually translates as this, he who is without this sin, i.e. adultery, cast a stone. Well, now you see we have a problem. Many things they were, but they weren't adulterers. Okay? So they can technically throw a stone. Yes, but they wanted Jesus to condemn her, so the Romans would take issue with him. And they also know now they hadn't brought the woman, the man, and they hadn't brought the witnesses. It's all starting to unravel. Then it says in the text, Jesus bent down and scribbled a second time. And many scholars think he wrote Jeremiah 17:13. I'll read this version. I'll read you a different one in a minute. O Lord, the hope of Israel, all who forsake you will be put to shame. Those who turn away from you will be written in the dust because they have forsaken the Lord, the spring of living water. But perhaps I think he may have also written, thou shalt not murder, which they have already been committing in their hearts because they hoped she'd be dead and then they hoped he'd be dead. So he's naming the sin in their hearts before they've carried it out. Jesus is amazing, because this second scribble is actually giving them a chance. They could have repented at that point and went, oopsie, oh dear, okay, this isn't going well. Because they must have heard God call them in their conscience, all right, bringing to mind all the times they'd heard about this verse. Do you remember we talked about Yom Kippur? At the end of Yom Kippur, every single year, the high priest would immerse himself 11 times in a mikveh, which is a reminder of this, right? In between, so that he's ceremonially clean during the last day of the Yom Kippur. Okay? At the very end of it, which is only 5 days before this festival, there was a celebration at the priest's house. And so that everybody would go away, and then they knew it had finished, he would come out and he would read this verse. And I'm going to read it in the Hebrew translation. O Yahweh, the immerser, baptizer of Israel, all those who leave your way shall be publicly embarrassed. All those who turn away from your ways will have their names written in the dust and blotted out, for they have departed from Yahweh, the fountains of the waters of life. And I can't say those other ones properly. Any religious man would have heard these verses quoted every year since he was 12. Okay? So if he was one of these guys was 50, he'd have heard it 39 times. So the oldest peeled away because they'd felt the heat of the verse more strongly. Let's turn a few minutes, turn our attention to the woman. Why did she commit adultery? She knew God's laws, okay, and she knew she could get stoned. What was her life? We don't know. But little girls, remember, that time were betrothed and married, sometimes at the age of 12 or 13, to extended family often. Women had no civil rights, no education. They were not taught the Torah. Maybe she was trapped. She was also trapped in a loveless, cruel, dull, unfulfilling marriage to a man she didn't love and she certainly didn't fancy. Maybe, I'm just surmising. But she definitely was trapped because she risked being stoned to death because she knew if the affair was caught, she'd be in trouble. But we also know it takes two to tango. And she was only half of the pair. So why did Jesus respond to this woman with such compassion and forgiveness? Because Jesus knows those of us, all humanity, trapped in situations that are hopeless can be redeemed. Okay? That's you, that's me. If we're trapped, you're trapped, I'm trapped in a situation that's hopeless, we can be redeemed. And at the end of the exchange, Jesus says this famously, "Nor do I condemn you, go and sin no more." What do we make of that line? I'm not going to give you 30 seconds because we haven't got any, but I'm just going to unpack a bit. We often think this, oh, I'm so glad he tells her off. I mean, she's done a really bad thing. And I mean, of course, he's not going to stone her because that's barbaric. And this is Jesus we're talking. But she does need to be put in her place and told off. And that's our job now because we're church. And that's our job is to tell people off when they're caught sinning. Is that what he's doing? What does go and sin no more mean? Well, it means so much more than stop seeing your lover. Because what is sin? We tend to think of sin as what we fail to do or what we do. And I want to just look at it upside down. Francis Spufford, in his brilliant book called Unapologetic, says sin is this. It's a human propensity to muck things up, to break things, and to ruin things. Do we recognize ourselves in the following? Ruining an atmosphere by being in a really bad mood. Breaking a friendship by being too competitive, too critical, or secretive. Do we smash trust by lying to the point that even we can't keep track of the lies? Do we erode family time because of work commitments that may not actually be necessary? Do we hurt others and ourselves by listening to peer pressure instead of loving, true advice? Do we trash our world by lazy behaviour, deliberate ignorance and greed? Do we poison our bodies with too much sugar, saturated fat, nicotine, weed or porn? Do we confuse people by choosing to live different lives on Sunday than the rest of the week? And do we damage our church family by not being honest with each other? So when Jesus tells her to go and sin no more, he is asking her to embrace her true identity as a child of God. Go back, repair it if possible. Be reunited with your family, your community, restore trust, rebuild relationships, be the changing factor, be the life giver in your circumstance, become the solution and change because of your encounter with him. It's so much more than stop. It means start living properly. And trust me, when she goes back, lives the Jesus way, we can guarantee everything changes. So how are we embracing this when we meet Jesus? When he pardons and restores us, what do we need to do to be the catalyst for change? But I also like to think that Jesus' voice carried. If you read on in the bit that my kids read, the Pharisees hadn't gone very far, actually, because they're straight back on him. What do you mean you say this? They haven't gone very far. So I like to think of Jesus calling out to them, go and sin no more. Because they too could have been life givers to the establishment. They could have apologized. They could have regrouped. They could have rethought. But instead, they choose to be challenged and walk away. They choose to see their position, but not change it. And this is tragic. Because in this encounter, we have the King of Grace putting her feet on solid ground and sending her off into a new life, and they don't like it. They accept it and leave, but they don't accept it and change. They don't accept it and change, which I found really challenging. So what about us? I know bracelets will say, what would Jesus do? But I'd like to say, what would I do? What would I do in that situation? Do I have the courage to look at myself in the glaring light of day? Do I really face myself down and think about what it is that I'm like in Jesus' sight, in good and bad, but am I honest? Do we have the courage to look at ourselves and hear what Jesus wants to change? Instead of the older ones setting the example for the youngers, in this they left for reasons I've explored. So challenge to us older ones. Do we model humility, honesty, and love? Do we lead by soul-searching, honest reflection, and then change our behavior to fit in with Jesus? Or do we sell out to mediocrity, pride, and self? I'm holding the challenge to myself. After these guys peel away, Jesus returns to teach in the crowds that are left by saying, I am the light of the world. On the very morning, remember, that the four great lamps in the temple have been finally extinguished after 8 nights of light show. You think that was bright? You ain't seen nothing yet. Because I am the light of the world. So to them, we don't get the light of the world, move on. This is what he's saying, the powerful message he's saying there. I am the light of the world. I am the illuminating presence of God. I am the pillar of fire in your desert. I am the temple where God lives. So to end, two kinds of people faced Jesus that day. The religious leaders who thought if they were smart enough, worked hard enough, prayed hard enough, that somehow they would earn their way into God's favor. And the woman who most likely thought her life was probably over. And now us. Because we face Jesus today, we face him here now. Where the Spirit of the Lord is, we sang earlier, there is freedom, healing, and hope. So hear the voice of love today as he calls you to be restored. Hear his voice of encouragement and conviction. Go sin no more. Turn your circumstances around. And some of us need to hear the voice of rebuke. Choose to repent and fully live. Let's ask ourselves honestly this question. What would Jesus scribble in the dust at our feet if he was right here now? To conclude, because this is a very Jewish heritage here, I've asked Andy and Eli to sing, as you reflect on what God might have said to you, they're going to sing a song, which is Hebrew. The words don't matter because I want you to just let the Hebrew flow over you. To remember that we have a Jewish Christ, he was Jewish, and all our heritage gives us so much more meaning to how we live our lives as Christians. Please reflect. If you want to pray with anyone, pray with me or any of the prayer team, that's fine. But otherwise, just reflect as they sing this through. The song is a song of praise to God, and it calls him holy, holy, holy. So, yeah, wonderful. And at the end of that, just a time of quiet, and you can go on your way.